health crisis in order to avoid political consequences. But at least he knows the name of the virus, right?
So you can't put them down in the category of the overall population in terms of this corona flu.
Jesus. The corona flu. Not only is he lying, he's making up new diseases now. It's called the corona swine Ebola flu. We just came up with very exciting. You can find it on the drive-thru menu at Wendy's. This is the kind of public health crisis that tests the competence and honesty of our president. And obviously, Trump is completely unequipped on both counts. We need truth, transparency, and testing, and we're not going to get it from Donald Trump. Then again, that's
just my hunch.
We have it totally under control.
We think it's going to have a very good ending for us, so that I can assure you.
I don't think it's inevitable. It may get bigger, it may get a little bigger, it may not get bigger at all.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Everything is under control.
The global death rate at 3.4%.
Well, I think the 3.4% is really a false number.
It's going to all work out. Everybody has to be calm.
No matter nowhere, we're taking care of it.
We're going to win so much, you're going to get so tired of winning. Just so tired.
President Trump visited the CDC to address the coronavirus outbreak. Let's listen in.
I think we're doing a really good job in this country at keeping it down. We've really been very vigilant, and we've done a tremendous job at keeping it down. But who would have thought?
Woo! Yeah! Thank you so much for misinforming the public. I have so many people to thank. I couldn't have become a national emergency without the help of these people. First of all, the big guy, Donald Trump. I wouldn't be here if not for you. You're insane, and I love it. Secretary Azar, Mike Pence, thank you for your complete and utter incompetence. You know, when you become a virus, all you want is to touch as many people as possible, and I have, all thanks to these ass-covering pieces of garbage. Okay, my little spores, Daddy did it. Don't wash your hands, everyone. Together we can do this. Oh, and free Roger Stone, okay. Good night, everyone.
Good evening, and welcome to the Ingram Angle. I'm Laura Ingram, the Joey Fatone of Fox News. Tonight's main story, I don't know why, coronavirus. The left continues to wage its deceitful, dishonest, and frankly gay smear campaign against President Trump. The left is trying to whip people into a fear frenzy of lies, which just isn't right. That's our thing. Look, coronavirus is an urban legend. And yes, I said urban as a dog whistle. The point is, you've got much bigger things to worry about. For more on this liberal fan fiction that is the coronavirus, we go to Judge Jeanine Pirro.
Get rid of her!
Get rid of who?
Whoever!
Okay, thanks for joining us, Jeanine. Should our viewers be doing anything to prepare for a coronavirus?
Hell no! Americans are not at risk, especially not our viewers, who skew elderly, are in bad health, live cloistered together in homes specifically for sick people, and have smoked their entire lives.
Sounds like you're not too worried.
Not one bit, Laura, so don't get it twisted. If you see me avoiding Chinese restaurants, it's not because I'm scared. It's because I don't trust the Chinese.
With people concerned about the growing death toll of this outbreak, today Trump tweeted, "So last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27,000 and 70,000 per year. Nothing is shut down, life and the economy." Go on. "At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about it."
Okay, let me think about that. You're a monster. Here's the thing. We can criticize Trump's golfing and tweeting, but when he hunkers down and focuses on the problem, that's when he really sucks. Case in point, on Friday, he'd headed down to the CDC to reassure the public, but he led off with some less than encouraging words about the people who are currently sick.
"Most of those people are going to be fine. A vast majority are going to be fine."
Trump went on to explain why he's the best person to handle this pandemic.
"You know, my uncle was a great person. He was at MIT. He taught at MIT for, I think, like a record number of years. He was a great super genius, Dr. John Trump. I like this stuff. I really get it. People are surprised that I understand it."
No. No, he's right. I would be very surprised if you understood it. I don't care how smart your uncle was. Epidemiology is not genetic. You don't get your mother's eyes and your father's PhD. Knowledge does not get passed down in the family. That's why, no matter how much we all know it now, future generations are going to have to learn for themselves that you're an idiot. Up until now, there have not been enough coronavirus test kits available, but Trump says that problem is solved.
Anybody that wants a test can get a test. That's what
I would just say that we...
Anybody right now and yesterday, anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the test.
Wow, that is so reassuring and so not true. 1.1 million tests were just distributed for a country of 328 million. So, yeah, no. But, according to Trump, these tests aren't just everywhere. They're also just the best.
They have the tests, and the tests are beautiful. The tests are all perfect. Like, the letter is perfect. The transcription was perfect, right? This was not as perfect as that, but... pretty good.
So, the coronavirus tests are almost as perfect as his Ukrainian phone call. We're all gonna die. Now, Trump, that rarely gets a laugh. That knowledge rarely gets a laugh.
On Friday, the president signed a funding bill from Congress to help combat the virus. And really pay attention to what he says here.
So we're signing the $8.3 billion. I asked for $2.5 billion, and I got $8.3 billion, and I'll take it.
Okay. He only asked for $2.5 billion. Congress said, we authorized $8.3 billion, and he's bragging that he wanted less? I don't know. He somehow finds a way to brag about everything.
Today, the World Health Organization officially called the coronavirus outbreak a global pandemic, and a WHO official said they were seeing, quote, alarming levels of inaction. And there's no excuse for that, because we've had months to learn from other countries that have been dealing with the crisis. Right now, for example, we have over 1,000 cases here in the U.S. Experts say we're basically on the same trajectory as Italy, just about 10 days behind them. And by Monday, the number of cases in Italy had shot up so drastically that the government had to put the entire country on lockdown.
It's Donald Trump's own former Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert who's today warning us in a statement to NBC News that, quote, we are 10 days from the hospitals getting creamed.
It's now in 110 countries with over 122,000 confirmed cases, and it looks like it's only getting worse.
Bottom line, it's going to get worse.
Gee, there's a bug, there's a flu, there's a virus. I didn't know what it was in China. And I said, uh-oh, that doesn't sound good. But it's working out very professionally. We're doing a tremendous job.
So far, we've done a great job.
We've done a great job.
We have done a great job.
We're doing a fantastic job.
We really think we've done a great job.
We're really prepared.
We're ahead of it.
And everything is under control. I mean, they're very, very cool.
And now everybody's complimenting me, saying thank you very much.
It's like an A++++.
A lot of good things are happening.
A lot of very exciting things are happening. They're happening very rapidly.
Tremendous success beyond what people would have thought.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
And the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero. That's a pretty good job we've done.
You know, the president, Trump, is a well-known germaphobe. And he's said to be going around the White House lately saying, I can't get sick, I can't get sick. He's reportedly been banishing staffers who he thinks could infect him from his office. President publicly seems determined to keep shaking hands. He has said that and that he will not cancel his rallies, but a report today from Vanity Fair says he is privately terrified about getting the virus and thinks journalists will try to purposefully contract coronavirus to give it to him on Air Force One. Well, that doesn't seem paranoid at all. That's...
Back here in this country, two members of Congress are putting themselves under quarantine because a man attending a large gathering of Republicans tested positive for the coronavirus. Senator Ted Cruz and Congressman Paul Gozer say they had contact with the man at last month's event known as CPAC.
Two additional Republican congressmen will undergo self-quarantine. Matt Gaetz and Doug Collins join Senator Ted Cruz.
The president has now come into contact, close contact, with two people who have come into close contact with somebody who has the coronavirus, both Matt Gaetz, who is with him today, and Doug Collins, who shook hands with him on Friday.
We don't know the identity of the CPAC attendee who was infected,
But one thing we know for sure, the unnamed individual had no interaction with Trump. Trump did reportedly shake hands with CPAC Chairman Matt Schlapp, who had interacted with the infected person, which makes the president just 2 degrees of separation away from the virus. Oh, no! Well, at least Gates didn't shake Trump's hand. Instead, he was seen boarding Air Force One with Trump today. His timing could not have been worse. Gates only learned that he'd been exposed to the virus after Air Force One lifted off from Orlando. He then essentially quarantined himself, sitting in a section of the plane alone. Oh, that definitely works. I'm going to sit in the section of the pressurized cabin where they recycle all the air.
Ben Terrace says he just spoke to Representative Gates, who said he was put into a closed-up room on Air Force One, as you mentioned, after he found out he might have been exposed to COVID-19. After landing, Trump coaxed him up to the front before leaving. He was not hyper-cautious about being in the same space that I was in, said Gates. He also said, I refused to go into his office. I stood outside the door. I told him he could talk from that distance. He also said, I've been with the president for the last 3 days. I was at a fundraiser with the president this afternoon, and he was shaking hands, taking pictures, just like he always does. This conventional wisdom that he's a germaphobe, is he actually a germaphobe?
He has said himself that he is, but he...
This isn't the behavior of a germaphobe.
But it is one. I mean, you know this, too, that the staffers initially really had to coax him to shake hands at the very beginning of his campaign. And as the campaign went on and he's become president, he's become more comfortable with it, though the hand sanitizer is never
just
too far
away. Just the level of caution. I mean, how can the president have a representative who had been in contact with the coronavirus patient? I mean, isn't there a staff member in place that says, hey, no, I know you might want to talk to him, but this is a really bad idea?
It's one of two things. Either the president is not taking this seriously, so therefore he doesn't think he can get that sick if he were to get it, or he's trying to project confidence and strength and say, this isn't that big of a deal. I'm still going to be dealing with someone who's been exposed to it.
So what are we going to wait for the press conference? Yeah. Like in
Has
Iran
he been tested?
The health ministers, like everything's fine?
We were told as of this morning, the president had not yet been tested for this virus.
I wonder if that changes.
As an older man who's not in great shape and spends his time touching strangers, he's definitely at risk. If Trump is not careful, he could get sick. He could be incapacitated, or worst of all, he could be trapped in quarantine with Ted Cruz.
Looks like the president is now 1 degree of separation from the virus, because today Trump congressional buddy Doug Collins tweeted that he, too, shook hands with the anonymous CPAC coronavirus donor and is currently in self-quarantine. Thankfully, since CPAC ended, Collins has laid low and only shaken the hand of one leader of the free world. Look at that.
Touch me, I'm sick. When an emergency comes along, he doesn't care about solving it. He just wants to BS his way through it. And now he's actively making the situation worse. The president is a deluded idiot who thinks he's a...
super genius.
If you open the beaches on the 4th of July, it's like ringing the dinner bell, for Christ's sake.
We're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. Be calm. It's really working out, and a lot of good things are going to happen.
I think there's no confidence in the president in anything he says or does. He turns everything into what he thinks is a political benefit for himself, and he's actually imploding in the process. But there's a lot of innocent bystanders that are being badly hurt. And I wish he would just be quiet. I really mean it. That's a reason. Awful thing to say about a president. Well, he'd be quiet. Just let the experts speak and acknowledge whatever they suggest to him is what we should be doing.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down. And the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. But nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make. And he never seems to notice, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Tell what he wants to do, and he never shows his feelings, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. See the world spinning round. Oh.
We'll be right back. isolation. Splendid isolation. I don't need no one. Splendid isolation.
We're afraid to be alone. got to have a home. Isolation. Just a boy and a little girl trying to change the whole wide world. Just a little town, everybody trying to put us down. Isolation. I don't expect you to understand. To blame, you're just a human, a victim of the insane. We're afraid of everyone, afraid of the sun.
Deborah from Athens, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Acra.
Rock, 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 rock and roll. Hi, this is Anya.
And this is Peter.
And we host a show called Rock and Roll High School.
on WGXC. First Monday of the month.
8 to 10 p.m. Tune in.
Tune in.
Ooh.
We did it at the same time.
Yeah. Fun, fun,
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tunstall Studio Publishing of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
Bernie Sanders is not Biden time. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Former Vice President Joe Biden did well on Super Tuesday, too, winning a majority of the six states in the March 10th Democratic presidential nomination contest. The cable pundits and Democratic Party elites quickly pounced on the results, demanding Sanders drop out of the race, calling for an abrupt cancellation of the remaining primaries and debates. Democratic South Carolina Congressmember James Clyburn told NPR,
"I think when the night is over, Joe Biden will be the prohibitive favorite to win the Democratic nomination. And quite frankly, if the night ends the way it has begun, I think it is time for us to shut this primary down. It's time for us to cancel the rest of these debates."
James Carville, a Democratic operative with decades-long ties to the Clintons, told MSNBC,
"Let's shut this puppy down and let's move on and worry about November. This thing is decided. There's no reason to keep it going, but not even a day longer."
Alicia Garza, an Elizabeth Warren supporter who co-founded the Black Lives Matter Global Network, tweeted, "I couldn't disagree more. Keep the debates and make sure that the issues that black people care about are being discussed. Biden needs to work for these votes," she tweeted. Alicia Garza then spoke on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
What's real is that when we're talking about the Democratic National Convention, we need to make sure that we are literally ensuring the integrity of the process. And the integrity of the process is not about skipping steps. It's about letting voters hear from candidates about the issues that are important to us.
Reverend William Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Movement, tweeted, "The Poor People's Campaign insists primary debate should not end until Biden and Sanders address the poverty that affects 140 million Americans, 52.1% of children, 61% of African Americans, and 66 million whites," Barber tweeted. More than 30 state and territorial primaries and caucuses have yet to be held, representing perhaps as many as 40 million Democratic voters. Naomi Klein, senior correspondent at The Intercept, who has formally endorsed Sanders, appearing on the Democracy Now! NewsHour on Wednesday morning, said,
"Everybody who is talking about shutting it down and unity are talking about protecting their candidate from voters, and Donald Trump is not going to shut any puppies down. He is going to go after Joe Biden with the gloves off. And I know it was very popular to say a while back that Bernie Sanders has not been vetted. Look, Joe Biden, before that fateful primary in South Carolina, had been written off by many of the pundits who are now saying that he is inevitable. So it has been months since we have put real scrutiny on this candidate with the full spotlight of a presidential debate, and we absolutely have to do it.
Senator Sanders himself ended any speculation he would be dropping out, speaking early Wednesday afternoon.
Donald Trump is the most dangerous president in the modern history of our country, and he must be defeated. Tragically, we have a president today who is a pathological liar and who is running a corrupt administration. He clearly does not understand the Constitution of the United States and thinks that he is a president who is above the law. In my view, he is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, and a religious bigot, and he must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen.
Sanders then challenged Joe Biden, offering several questions he intends to ask his Democratic opponent at the next debate, the first head-to-head debate between the two, to be held in Phoenix this Sunday with no audience due to the coronavirus pandemic.
Joe, what are you going to do for the 500,000 people who go bankrupt in our country because of medically related debt? And what are you going to do for the working people of this country and small business people who are paying on average 20% of their incomes for health care? Joe, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of the United States of America being the only major country on earth where health care is not a human right? Are you really going to veto a Medicare for All bill if it is passed in Congress? Joe, how are you going to respond to the scientists who tell us we have 7 or 8 years remaining to transform our energy system before irreparable harm takes place to this planet because of the ravages of climate change? Joe, at a time when most young people need a higher education to make it into the middle class, what are you going to do to make sure that all of our people can go to college or trade school regardless of their income? And what are you going to do about the millions of people who are struggling with outrageous levels of student debt? Joe, at a time when we have more people in jail than communist China, a nation 4 times our size, what are you going to do to end mass incarceration and a racist criminal justice system? And what are you going to do to end the terror that millions of undocumented people experience right now because of our broken and inhumane immigration system? Joe, what are you going to do about the fact that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth, and are living with the fact that 500,000 people tonight are homeless and 18 million families are spending half of their income to put a roof over their heads? Joe, importantly, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of billionaires buying elections and the 3 wealthiest people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of our people?
Sanders highlighted 2 key ways his campaign is clearly winning, earning the votes of younger voters and promoting bold policies that are clearly much more popular than the incremental reforms offered by Biden. Bernie Sanders won more than 3/4 of the 18 to 29-year-old vote and a majority of 30 to 44-year-olds. Latinos also turned out by significant majorities for Sanders. He won close to 90% of the Arab American vote in Dearborn, Michigan, the Detroit suburb with the highest concentration of Arab Americans in the country. A clear majority of Democratic voters nationally, despite which candidate they voted for, supports a single-payer health care system like Medicare for All over the current for-profit system. This holds true even in Mississippi.
There was a coalition that could have won, a progressive coalition, and that could still win, but obviously the chances are much slimmer.
Again, that's Naomi Klein.
It is not about Bernie. People in this movement are not fighting for Bernie Sanders. They're fighting for Medicare for all. They're fighting for a Green New Deal. They are fighting for the issues that they need to survive.
Both Biden and Sanders canceled their Super Tuesday 2 evening rallies due to the coronavirus threat. Soon after, President Trump announced plans for a large rally in Milwaukee next week. Under enormous pressure, he's since walked that back. In this time of contagion and crisis, the Democrats should demand more debate and more voter participation, not less, as a vaccine against the science-denying, reality-denying commander-in-chief who imperils us all. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Okay, and up next, we have a guest in the studio, Blue Carriker of the New York Statewide Coalition
for Paid Leave.
For paid leave. There you go. Welcome, Blue.
Thank you very much.
So why don't you let us know what this coalition is?
Sure. So first of all, I'm a campaigns manager at Citizen Action New York, and I've been working on paid leave issues for workers in New York State for 6 years now. The members of the coalition are both statewide and local organizations who have an interest in making sure that workers not only have economic stability, but that they don't have to fear loss of pay or loss of job when they have to take time to take care of themselves or a member of their family. So that's what the coalition is focused on. We helped pass the New York Paid Family Leave Act, and now we're working on other issues, including paid sick days.
So I see here that New York City has had paid sick leave since 2014. Why is New York State so far behind?
Well, that's a very good question. And they are far behind. And when we are in a situation like we are now, that fact makes things even more difficult. And it's not just that New York City, which had one of the first laws in the country, there are now 11 states and 38 municipalities across the country that have actually passed paid sick days legislation. So New York is way behind. New York is often a leader on worker issues, but not in this way.
Yeah. Well, this is a really tender time for the subject to be brought up, and I understand there's something's going through legislation at the moment.
Well, what happened was the governor, Governor Cuomo, introduced a policy for statewide paid sick days in the budget. And the coalition had been working with his staff to make sure that the elements of that policy proposal had all the strength and the key elements that were part of the New York City law and other laws that have been passed recently. And we felt after chapter amendments, his edits of what was in the original budget, after they were done, that we were in a good place. And we were working to make sure that the legislators would agree to do that in the budget. Then all of a sudden, as a response to COVID-19 and the pandemic, they have decided to take it out of the budget with the expectation they'll do it even before the budget is done. And the governor is working now with legislative leaders on a bill where they expect to introduce next week. Early next week. And it will not only have paid sick days, it will now have extra provisions to address the impact of quarantines and work closures on workers.
What is the amount of sick pay? Is it usually the whole total work week pay, or is there a percentage or a portion of
that? So it's different from paid family leave, which people, I hope, are now familiar with, which gives you, next year when it's fully implemented, 2/3 of your average weekly wage, and that's paid for by the employee, right? They give small payroll deductions in all their checks that goes to an insurance policy, and that insurance policy pays them when they're out for a long period of time. You can take up to 12 weeks to care for yourself or a family member. Paid sick days is for short-term illnesses, the flu, strep throat, pink eye, your annual appointments, your mammography, all of those things. That's covered underpaid sick days. So what has been introduced and what's happening in New York City and other places is often you earn 1 hour of paid sick time for every 30 hours that you work. If you're full-time by the end of the year, you have 5 full or 40 hours a year. That's minimal. But that's setting a minimal standard. So there's about 40% of workers who often don't have any paid sick days at all. Those are low-wage, hourly, part-time workers who don't have that benefit. That's what we're trying to cover here and insist that every employer provide that minimum. And they can, of course, provide more.
So this is going to be a mandate on employers that if you're out, you're still going to be paid.
That's right. And the employer is paying you. Right.
Okay.
Doesn't the mere fact that it's been dedicated or distinguished as a pandemic have a legal reference from the government? Is there some kind of connection there between actually making this a pandemic?
Well, that was the World Health Organization that announced today it was a pandemic. I'm not sure what ramifications that has for state or federal law. I think we, as far as I can see, it's up to states and up to federal government to decide how they're going to handle this.
So in the state, who are the key players in this fight?
So right now, clearly, it's the governor and his staff and the leaders of both of our chambers, Hasty in the Assembly and Stewart-Cousins in the Senate. Once it is introduced, however, we don't know if other legislators will come in and try to change it in one way or another. That's what we need to watch carefully. We don't want to see a weakening of the basic paid sick days law, and we want to see the important job protection and wage replacement elements to deal with the virus.
So if you work for, let's say, a union, and the union already offers it, or an employer already offers it, it's not going to matter. This would be, this legislation would be mandated paid sick leave.
Right. So those who are working under a collective bargaining agreement, that organization, if it has generally the same benefits, can opt out of the law. That's part of the written in, or they can use it in their bargaining. All right, so the unions have requested that, and that is part of the law. But if you're not under a collective bargaining agreement, this is mandate.
So what would be the minimum work hours? I think you mentioned it, but can you repeat it again?
Sure. What the outline that was in the budget said, and this is based on many other laws. So first of all, you earn 1 hour for every 30 hours that you work, okay? That if you are an employer and you have under 5 employees, you are able to provide unpaid sick time. If you're an employer between 5 and 99 employees, you have to provide 5 days a year or 40 hours. If you have 100 or more, then you need to provide 7 days of paid sick days in a year.
Okay. What does the coronavirus pandemic have on the urgency of this issue?
Well, it's obviously made it obvious. I'm sorry, obviously made it obvious. That was good. But no, it has made it so abundantly clear that workers need coverage if they have to stay home sick. And the fact that so many people don't have that coverage, they are pressured to come to work sick. And if their child is sick, what are they going to do? Are they going to stay home with that child or take a chance of losing their shift, losing their pay, or losing their job? And that's happening now. That's the climate in which we are trying now to combat an terribly infectious disease.
So what kind of pushback are you getting from business leader group?
We tried to pass this law in Albany County for 2 years, and we had huge pushback from business who had lots of exaggerated expenses. We have lots of evidence now across the country. This is good for business as well as the employee. The biggest expense for business is the loss and turnover of staff and having to hire them. Paid sick days increases the retention of employees. It also decreases absenteeism because when a worker comes to work sick, they spread it throughout the workplace. And it decreases public health costs because it decreases emergency room visits and decreases the amount of time that somebody may be sick or injured. Because if you go and get it diagnosed and you stay home early when you need to, your disease is not likely to get worse.
So this paid sick leave would cover the employee, whether they're sick and they have to take care of somebody at home.
It covers three things. If you're sick yourself, if your family member is sick, also if you're a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, you can use that time to seek services related to that experience.
Oh, that's fantastic. Can you just give me some information about what we can do as the public to encourage or to discuss this with our legislatures?
Right, so I suggest you go to the Citizen Action website. You can get more information there, but definitely you want to contact your legislator and say, I can't believe that workers don't have paid sick days. You need to pass this now, pass it quickly, and we need some extra coverage because of the pandemic that we're facing. But just stop delaying and get this done.
Okay. So we just heard from Blue Carriker, statewide facilitator of the New York Statewide Paid Leave Coalition, through a group and citizen action.
That's right.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes? Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
I'm joined by Jose Saldana, the director of RAP, Release Aging People in Prison. He is here to talk about coronavirus and prisons. Thank you for joining me on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today, Jose.
And thank you for having me.
To start out, on Monday, March 9th, Governor Cuomo advertised New York making its own hand sanitizer. He said, "We're introducing New York State clean hand sanitizer made conveniently by the state of New York." Can you talk about this product, where it is made, and what Governor Cuomo left out in this announcement?
Well, first of all, he left out that he was actually paying the incarcerated men their slave wages. And he also left out that they're making a product, that, and it's a good thing that they're making a product to help the community address this really health crisis, but unfortunately they will not benefit from it because it won't be available to them because of the alcohol-based contents of the product.
Could you elaborate?
It means that in prison, I'm formerly incarcerated, so we are not allowed to have anything that is flammable or has alcohol in it. This includes lotion and creams. When they scrutinize every product, reading the ingredient, if it has alcohol, it's not going to be allowed into the prison.
Jose Saldana, as someone who has spent 38 years behind bars and is now the director of RAP, Release Aging People in Prison, can you speak from your experience about how viruses like coronavirus affect prison populations?
We're concerned with all lives that are incarcerated in New York State. And we focus on the elderly because the elderly are very vulnerable to such viruses. They're vulnerable to just about anything that challenges health in prison. And a virus of this nature, which is a novel virus, you know, they don't really know a whole lot about it. So the prison bureaucrats, they don't have a plan for this. You would think that they would because they had to face the HIV/AIDS crisis of the 80s and 90s. There was a crisis of hepatitis C. There's always outbreaks about tuberculosis outbreaks. And you would think that the Department of Correction in New York State will be prepared for such health crisis, but they're not. And they're not strictly because their main concern, and it's, the overriding concern, is security. And most of the financial resources goes to security, not to the health. And a report was just put out by the Correctional Association of New York, which is an oversight committee. And in the report, they state that 70% of the incarcerated men and women in New York State say that they had not seen a doctor in a year when they needed one. An entire year waiting to see a doctor. So this obviously tells us that the medical facilities in New York State are woefully inadequate.
Jose, what was the response in specific cases when you were in prison when you had such outbreaks?
The immediate response was punitive in nature, is to just take people out the general population and isolate them. And that we're not talking about isolating them in rooms, isolate them in dorms, 30 or 40 in a dorm. And we're talking about people who are just suspected of having HIV. This is back when it first hit the prison system, and they knew very little about it. So they punished anybody who lost. If you lost weight, you might as well just check in, because they were going to place you in these dormitories with everybody else. And they did this with tuberculosis also. And we're talking about airborne disease. But if they suspected people who were in an area where someone was detected to have active tuberculosis, they would take everybody, put them in a dormitory. Now, if you didn't have tuberculosis, you would definitely be exposed to it if somebody in that dormitory with you had active tuberculosis. But this is the nature of corrections. They focus first on punishing and getting people out the area so they don't have to see them again. Unfortunately, this is still their focus. This virus is a novel virus, from what I'm hearing. It's going to hit. It's only a question of when, and it's fatal to the elderly. I could just see those who are infirm and bedridden in regional medical units across the state, where people are just placed there to die. The only aftercare, end-of-life care, is neglect. I could just see, you know, them just forgetting about them and just letting them die in their beds.
Now, RAP, along with a coalition of other groups, have been working on several reform bills, including one that would release aging people in prison. And now you have called for Governor Cuomo to release incarcerated people vulnerable to COVID-19. And in the wake of this pandemic, what should happen right now? What does that mean?
I think our bills and our call for clemency becomes an urgent call right now. The bill, which I'll briefly say, that it actually provides for parole hearings for anyone who has reached 55 and has served 15 years. This bill will actually benefit about 300 people who are closer to 70 and have already languished in prison for 3 to 4 decades. But this bill becomes urgent now, because we're talking about a population that is the least to commit another crime, the least to recidivate, and they're just languishing in prison now to die. Now that becomes more real. Governor Cuomo can take this opportunity to extend mercy to these men and women. Most of them have languished in prison, like I said, for 3 to 4 decades, and release them, because this virus will certainly kill them if it hits the way we think it's going to hit.
And as it stands now, the death rate in prison is high.
For the elderly, since Cuomo took office in 2011, at least 675 elder people have passed away in New York State prisons. And we say elder, we're starting at 50 years old. So that means 675 people that are 50 and over have passed away. And the average age of death is 58 years old. That in itself is alarming. And that in itself is a human crisis, man, of people dying at such a young age. 58 is relatively young nowadays.
A group of Democratic senators led by Elizabeth Warren are demanding to know what plans the Federal Bureau of Prisons have in place to protect inmates, staff, and their families from this infectious disease. They asked for a response by March 16th. What do you know about this, or what do you have to say about this?
I think we need a response now. We don't have to give weeks or days. I think this is such a critical issue right now. It's urgent that we need a response now. We don't have to wait until people start dying. We need the governor in New York State to respond to this issue right now, because he can save lives right now. He can make decisions that he should have made years ago, and that's to release this vulnerable population.